If I had a record that had 10 really good preserved issues, I would probably write on them. However, I can't say that I've done that. And I'm a little bit different in style than Melissa in that I'm a leaner writer. Leaner? Mm-hmm. More lean?
More concise, perhaps.
More concise writer. I don't want to waste time. What I can say in, you know, take a, you know, 10 words, I'm going to cut it down to 3. That's just my style of writing. So if an issue's preserved and I think it's good and I've got some good law, then I'm going to write on it. Now, that being said, I'm not scared to have a long brief. I think we had a long one together, mm-hmm. very, very long. But, and you still outdid my number of pages on that brief. I think that was about 8 points of error.
And not that size matters.
that was one of the longer ones I've done on a direct appeal that was not a death penalty case. But that also involved a very good trial attorney who preserved the issues. And I thought that they all had merit. The courts disagreed with me. However, if it's a good issue, I will write on it. But I would say I tend to more lean towards less is more. But if it's a good preserved issue, I'm writing on it.
What do you do in a circumstance when your client wants you to have a point of error about an issue that you do not either believe is legally meritorious or supported by the record? Do you, like, let's say, for example, the client is very dissatisfied with his trial attorney's performance and very much wants an ineffective assistance of counsel claim raised on direct appeal. You, as the appellate attorney, know that, of course, that's very hard to do frequently on the direct appeal side because the record is frequently not developed on those particular issues. Do you raise an IAC claim anyway because that's what your client wants, or do you take some alternative approach to that? How do you handle that?
I may be one of the rare ones where I'm not necessarily afraid to raise an IAC claim on direct appeal, even when there's a silent record. It just depends on the issue and how egregious I may feel that it is. But as far as letting my client dictate what's raised in an appellate brief, I'm firmly against that. I have the belief that I'm the lawyer, I went to law school, I will determine the strategy. It doesn't mean that I won't sit down with them and explain it. And if we don't see eye to eye, then, I mean, I guess if I'm retained, they can go in a different direction. I fortunately have not had that situation before. I have had some clients who are very vocal and firm in their belief that their attorney did something wrong. The record did not bear that out. And so I didn't write on it, and I won't do it, because I feel like my name goes on the brief. It's my reputation. It's my integrity. So that's what's important to me. Josh, I don't mean to call you out, Mr. Schaefer. How do you feel about that? You're going to write what you want to write. Is that... Now, does anyone who does defense, does anybody disagree that they feel like if the client hires you and pays you a lot of money, you're going to do, I mean, what they want you to do? Anybody? No. I would not. No. And I agree. And I can't think of any defense attorneys I know who would do that. And even the ones, and I don't use this as a derogatory term, but as a, you know, concierge lawyering, they charge a lot of money. And for that money, they are on call all the time. I wouldn't say that is how my practice is. But some people do. And even those lawyers, I'd be surprised if they would let them dictate what to write in a brief. It can be difficult and it can be dicey, but again, it comes down to it's your name on the brief and it's your work and your integrity.
Well, and then there's also the point where you don't want to not really waste time, but you don't want to raise issues that aren't fully developed and then potentially limit their ability to raise that an IAC claim on a writ, for example, right? You don't want to take that bite away from them.
Right.
One thing that I've really enjoyed about Mandy's briefs in those that we've had together, and I think that I do it too, is she does a very good job of when she has multiple issues that pertain or involve the same standard of review or some of the same law, she does a very good job of structuring the point of error so that it avoids being multifarious and yet is concise at the same time with the use of effective subheadings. Mm-hmm. Is that something that you find helpful to you when you're writing it to split it out that way?
It does. It helps. And this was something I started changing a few years ago. I don't know why I wasn't doing this from the beginning. But, for instance, if you've got, you know, multiple like a suppression issue, but it applies to multiple pieces of evidence or multiple suppression issues. Instead of each point of error, you're recounting the same standard of review and then going over. I've now started to, this standard of review applies to points of error 1, 2, 3, and 4. And so now we're cutting out, you know, 4 paragraphs or, you know, more on a standard of review. And I just, it's just the way my brain thinks. I hope that it makes it easier to read for both my colleague on the other side, for the judge, for the briefing attorney. And it also cuts out pages, which I'm always looking to do. Save the trees.
quick question about citations. In the paper, we talk about there's kind of two schools of thought with how legal citations should be done in legal documents. There's the traditional method of citing cases and statutes, et cetera, in the body text of the work. Then Brian Garner is a very strong advocate for taking those legal citations and using footnotes only. And there's kind of a split. So Mandy and I went through, and in the paper you can see examples that we've cited where the Court of Criminal Appeals is split basically down the middle with some judges. I want to say it was maybe, might be a 5-4 split. Some judges favoring the traditional body text citation approach and the other judges favoring the Garner approach.